and welcome to this week's Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we are surfing the airwaves thanks to OldFootballShirts.com. Well, ahead of this weekend's international break, we had an international break, and we came back from Wales with three needed points. Pretty goals are nothing to be scared of, Glenn. It was a win that lifted us to the heady heights of eighth and saw us register our fourth clean sheet of the season, earning our backline more plaudits, but not enough to earn Lewis Dunk a call-up to the England squad. Also this week, a strong-looking under-21 side ended this season's enrolment in the Checkatrade Trophy after succumbing 3-1 to Stevenage. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wes, and we're delighted to welcome a man who will be unknown to many of you, but is a real unsung hero at the club, and he's the man charged with unearthing the next Lewis Dunk. Welcome to John Morling.
Hiya, pleasure.
Thanks for coming on the Albion Raw, mate. We'll just say that John is head of the Albion Academy.
Academy manager, yeah.
Now, I mean, just to give us a brief overview of what you actually do at the club.
Well, manage the academy, everything really, from nines to 23s, you know.
And that case, I mean, nutshell. Okay, so if you're the overlord at the academy, tell us what it is, kind of roughly on a day-to-day basis, what it is that the academy manager does.
So we have teams for every age, 9s, 10s, 11s, all the way up to 23s. And obviously, with all them, they have the support staff that go with them. So coaches, physios, S&C staff, psychologists.
S&C?
Sports science.
Right.
And strength conditioning.
Right.
Teachers, psychologists. So a whole host of staff.
Yeah.
And obviously manage the operational side to make sure it all functions at the weekend.
Because, I mean, this might sound like a silly question, but I mean,
oh, you're good at them.
I am. But it's something that a lot of people are puzzled about and scratch their heads over. But what exactly is an academy?
So the academy really is a set of teams, really from 9s to 23s, that hopefully will have players filtering into the first team for many years to come and safeguard the club. In terms of the players that are going to have for the next generation. So within that, we'd have 152 players in the academy, from 9 to 23s, 35 full-time staff and another 74 part-time staff, working across a multitude of areas, hopefully then getting the best players in the area to Brighton, giving them a chance to play professional football through their local club. And obviously some players from further afield with the recruitment network that we've now got.
Is this for boys and girls?
I just run the boys, but there is a girls' academy as well.
Who's the boss of that? Tell us, is that a kind of a parallel setup there, or is it?
It's slightly different. The girls have their own setup, but we'll obviously function out of Lancing, and they'll have a separate set of guidelines, obviously, and parameters that they have to fit in order to fit their criteria, similar to what the boys would have.
Now, you came to the club in 2012. It was David Burke brought you in, wasn't
yeah.
it? But how did you actually get into coaching? Because, I mean, you're quite young now. And that, I know, that's amazing.
Cheers.
He's actually younger than us, believe it or not, I think.
Is he?
But, I know.
It's a bad lie.
Shocking. I mean, you started off, you were an academy player at Norwich, is that right?
Yeah, I played at Norwich from 11 to 16. Went to Scarborough then for a year.
You played at the Stadium of Chips?
Yes, it. McCann Stadium, yep. Played there for a year and then went back, carried on doing my A-levels and then got into coaching, really. I started coaching early when I was probably 13, going up to Norwich in school holidays.
13?
Yeah.
Coaching. Wow. So why so young?
Because when I went up, I was going up to Norwich in school holidays, so I'd train in the mornings and then help out on the summer camps and that in the afternoon.
Okay. So where are you from originally?
London.
From London, okay. Yeah. Whereabouts?
East London, so I grew up in Manor Park and then later on in Dagenham.
So, I mean, the fact that you're wearing a kind of burgundy-ish jumper, does that...
Are you criticising for sort of the claretness of his jumper?
I'm trying to grasp at straws.
I'm not sure it's claret, but anyway,
I don't
it's
think
bad
it's,
light.
It's yeah, kind of, yeah, red wine, isn't it? Yeah.
But I mean, is that where your allegiances lie growing up?
Yeah, that's where I grew up, yeah, and grew up as a West Ham supporter.
He sounds miserable. You can hear he's a West Ham fan.
Oh, here we go.
So, yeah, so you started at 13. Was it just something that, you know, the whole notion of coaching and tactics and what have you just sort of appealed to the 13-year-old John Morling?
Well, yeah, after training, obviously I went to summer camps, one, for a bit of pocket money, two, obviously to fill up the afternoons as well, and I always enjoyed it. And then from then, always worked in Scotland, doing extra coaching, etc. Done me coaching badge as early as I can at 17.
Wow.
Got my first full-time job at 19 when one of the staff went over from Norwich to Peterborough. Started full-time in a community programme, and then by 21, I'd had my full badge by then, which I was one of the youngest ones to do that at that time.
What's the badge we're talking about here?
It was called the full badge at the time.
Right.
And then that converted into the UEFA A licence later on. So at 21, then I was director of Centre of Excellence at Peterborough.
Because you make quite a big splash at Peterborough. Because I mean, when you came to the Albion, you didn't come from Peterborough, but there was a very big thing in the local Peterborough press about you coming to the Albion.
Yeah, I'll take your word for it. I'm sure.
Go on then. Who did you unearth at Peterborough then?
Well, it was obviously when you talk about youth development and a player goes from 9 to the first team or comes in at 14 or 15 to the first team, there's probably 20 people. At least that have been involved in their pathway from their Sunday league manager to the coaches to their family to S&C staff to medical staff, whatever that might be. So at Peterborough, we was lucky we had a good team of staff, and quite a few of the players obviously went on to good things.
Okay, so for instance, then, mate, come on, who are you responsible for?
I can't say I'm responsible solely, but a part of the team. The Simon Davis was there, Matthew Everington was there, Luke Steele went on. We sold him early on to Man United.
Yeah. Oh, that Luke Steele.
Yeah.
Well, Simon Davis scored in the European final.
He did.
Yeah.
Who else now? Put me on the spot now. Well, I'm trying to think.
Smith.
No, he was after. That was after.
Yeah, he was a Watford, wasn't he, first, wasn't he? Yeah, but he. Well, that, even those, just those three, so, you know.
Mark Tyler, Simon Rusk.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, right. Okay. Right. Okay. The dots are joined. Then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fine. Okay.
Well, we are going to go into a little bit more of what John does in more depth a little bit later on. But first, we have to talk about our trip to our own international break.
Yes.
To Swansea.
You don't need a passport to go to Wales, mate.
I know.
You just need £6.50 to cross the bridge.
And that's just to get out of Wales.
No, it's to get into Wales.
Is it to get in?
Yeah.
I thought it was to get out.
No, it's free to get out.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. Anyway.
That explains a lot. So we're unchanged for the third game in a row, which meant that Izquierdo was preferred to Solly March.
Mm-hmm.
It was certainly not going to win any awards for prettiness, this game.
Yes. When it got dealt the playing cards, it got a pair of twos, that did. It was a bit of a minger. It's a game so ugly only its mother could love it. But, you know, that Swansea, I think, because they've been here before, they've been in the Premier League for a few years. I mean, you know, this is, we're still on our, well, we like to convince ourselves we're still on our big adventure. So we'll take the points any way that they're coming to us. And if they happen to come flying into our hands thanks to a brilliant performance, or they drunkenly stagger up the pavement and fall at our feet vomit laden and there are points, we'll take them as well. So, you know, the fact that we won 1-0 against what was actually a very, very, you know, sloppy side. Mm.
Yeah, John, I mean, Swansea, a lot of their success was based on playing on a playing identity, which I believe is...
But this is Alan Martinez we're talking about here, about three or four managers ago.
Which was passed down throughout the whole club from the kids right way through to the first team. But they seem to have lost that identity a little bit at the moment.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think if you look at the two clubs and look at the two youth policies, very similar in terms of how we play and how our philosophies are. And our philosophy was really born from when Gus was here, and Gus had a big input into how we played and how we continue to play. And we've obviously tweaked.
So that's style of play's been maintained throughout the age groups.
Yeah, it's been maintained. It's been tweaked and evolved as we go, and we look at four different areas where. Where we concentrate on obviously defending, attacking, transition, defend, transition, attack. And by that I mean the first 6 seconds of each. So as soon as you lose a ball, first 6 seconds of winning it back is your transition, defend, and vice versa.
Okay.
So we look at them four areas, but also we look at in all the teams that we want to have more possession, more shots on target, and more goals scored than the opposition in 30% of our games. So what that means is we don't necessarily want to win 5-0 by booting it out of the pitch and not playing, and don't want to keep the ball for the sake of keeping it. So in 30% of our games, we want to try and get all three if we can. So that's they're little things that we try and aim towards.
Are you saying this is something similar that Swansea were doing, and they you feel they've abandoned it a bit, or that is it just
well,
not being done properly?
I think if you've got philosophies and values at the club, I think it can only be as strong as the leaders in at the club. So if the board at the club or whoever's in charge at the academy or who's in charge at director of football, wherever that might be, I think the values and the if they're strong values and the strong philosophies, they'll stay. Obviously, they'll evolve over time, and they've got to be kept. But I think if you change a lot at the top, it might dilute the values and what you're looking for.
Which is something that's happened a lot with Swansea when they've had four or five different managers over the last two seasons.
But if we're talking about since Gus, we're on our third manager, if my maths is right. Third manager since...
Well, we had Oscar Garcia, Sammy Hoopy, and now Chris.
Yeah, so we're on our third manager since Gus. But the point is that, and I think that's the point that John's making, is that the philosophy on the pitch, and we've seen it, hasn't changed a huge amount. I think that one of the things that's changed certainly since... You know, from because the point that John was making about sometimes keeping the ball for the sake of keeping the ball, and we did that an awful lot under Gus. But with Chris, you notice we're trying to get the ball forward a bit more. Now I'm giving you what we see. Now what you're actually trying to do might be something slightly different, or it might be we're missing a point. But I'm going on what we see.
Yeah, from a club point of view, clubs. Look, I'll go back a step. Really, the club's very stable in terms of the board, CEO and what goes on. And if a manager changes, like there's been manager changes since I've been here, all the staff know if a manager goes, what staff would go with him, and that's it. That's that change, and everyone would know that. Don't affect the academy, don't affect any department at all. So unlike other clubs where a manager might come in and change everything, they'll never happen at Brighton. Because
that does actually happen at other clubs, including right down to the academy level.
Yeah, it could do. Yeah.
So, what if you bring in a new manager? I mean, it sounds like seems to be almost like a civil service contingency thing, where you know, right, okay, we've got this manager and his management team is in place there, and supposing for the sake of argument, the next person comes in, whoever it might be, and they have a different philosophy. Are you saying that the manager that comes in has to more adhere to the academy's and therefore what's gone on previously, the club's philosophy? Or are you saying that a manager can come in, bring in their own philosophy, and the rest of the academy has to change to that? How in theory would it work?
In
your instance,
I think if you would speak to the board and what sort of managers that they would want, that it's not changed loads. It's changed in terms of they'd want to have a possession type team, and it's obviously changed now. It's evolved really over the last three or four years with different managers, and they will evolve it. But I don't think that we'll ever have a manager that's going to be very direct and back to probably what it would have been 15 years ago. I don't think that'll ever happen, because I think you've got to keep up with the times and what the fans want. And the fans at Brighton, what they would want to see and what they'd pay money to see, and I think you can see it in the Premier League as well at the moment, where if managers will get picked based on really what the fans are looking for, and if that don't happen, I think they're on an eye into nothing from day one.
Well, again, I mean, we mentioned that Swansea have had this traditional identity, but not as traditional as a team like West Ham, and they seem to be recruiting the manager who would. Doesn't really play in that particular identity. So,
I mean, it's an interesting appointment.
Absolutely, yeah. From all you're saying there, I mean, there's a couple of key fascinating points that have been raised on that. I mean, when Chris Hughton first came along and he was asked a question, what is your setup philosophy about how you want to play? And he said he prefers a 4-5-1, but with a kind of a attacking side. You know, so there was a touch of 4-3-3 about it. And yet, certainly in his first full season, I mean, Christ. We can never work out what Sammy was trying to do. So he inherited a little bit of a pickle, but by the time he could actually get everything in place for the new season, it was pretty clear it was a 4-4-2. So, you know, what had changed then within the, I'll say the word again, philosophy, that made him realise, well, as much as he wants to play 4-5-1, is it because of the fact of the players he's got, he's actually sort of set up his his system there to accommodate the players that he's got?
Yeah, I think you have to do that to a point, because you have to work with the players that you obviously inherit, and then over time you can put your own stamp on the team. But if I go back to probably what we would look at for all the ages and really concentrate on, and the two areas that may get neglected, I don't know, but we've really focused on a lot, is the two transitions, transition defend, transition attack. And I think you look at the team at the moment, and they'll be very good at that, and they've worked very hard, whether you're attacking or defending. And I think when you've got that, that's a good basis where you can then obviously start where you want to, in terms of your philosophy and how you want to play.
Yeah, well, I mean,
that's a big thing.
Jumping ahead a little bit here, because we are going to go into more depth about this in a bit. But I mean, say, for instance, you had a player in the 21s, 23s, possibly younger, even the 17s, perhaps, that you saw could do a job in the first team, that if from what you've seen from the first team is lacking, you think, right, Chris, I've got this player, he would fit into this. Could you actually do that? What would Chris do?
Yeah, how it works is that every age group, three times a year, we'd have a player audit. So what that is a player audit whereby all the staff that work with them players will have a real in-depth meeting, and everyone will say from their area how that player's doing. So you might have yellow, red, green, depending on how they're doing. In them areas, a very in-depth discussion on, one, how they've done, and two, their next step. What's their individual learning program look like now for the next 3 months, 4 months, whatever that might be. So with the older ones, with the under-23s, for instance, so we'll do our player audit with all the staff, so that's all the departments, people where they live, etc., etc., and then we'll take the summary of that into the first-team staff. So the first team staff will have a regular update of how everyone in the 23s are doing. But before that, Simon Rusk, who's our 23s manager, obviously meet with the first team staff every morning. And he's a part of that staff. So there'll be Chris and all the first team staff will be really aware of how everyone's doing from training and from a playing point of view.
Because, I mean, one question that was asked a lot, particularly at the beginning of this season, was... I'm just taking this from what I've read, from what other people have been saying, not necessarily what we think, but is that we've got this academy and we've got XYZ player and we've got this striker shortage. Couldn't someone like step up to solve that striker crisis because we didn't get anyone in the window?
If there was one ready to play at that particular time, I'm sure
someone like Aaron Connolly, for instance, who
was injured.
Yeah.
So so at that particular time, he come on against Barnet in the cup, and after that he went away. Vineland and got injured. So if he was fit, could he have got a chance? Possibly. And I think when you're a young player, you've got to be doing very, very well and wait for that opportunity. And when that opportunity comes, you've got to take it. But the thing with young players, you don't know when that opportunity is coming. So you might be an under-18 player, under-23 player. You come into training on any day. You get called over to the first team, and there's a great opportunity. If you do very well, brilliant. That might lead into something else if someone gets injured and you get given a chance. Like Jason Malumbi, for instance, been on the bench for the last three times. If someone's to get injured, he'll go on and play. He's just got to wait his opportunity. He's done very, very well of late, and he's just got to keep going.
I mean, but one player that would be very, very difficult to replace at the moment is Pascal Grosau.
Yeah, I mean, are you actually asking me whether I think there's anyone in the under-23s that's ready to take
him
over?
No.
I was about to say, because I haven't got a clue.
There's a massive gear cruncher.
There was a gear cruncher. I was about to say, I could have sworn we were talking about player development here.
We're
back at Swansea now.
We're
back at Swansea. Well, Pascal Grosau has done very well, and yet, as much as we can actually rave about him, there was a collector's item this season. It was an ungrossed goal. Because the goals was created by, you know, Bruno and Knockhart down the right, you know, where instead of sort of spending their entire first half chirping at each other, they played sort of very, I mean, Knockhart and Bruno were both lonely out on the wing for Murray's cross, for the cross to Murray, and Murray himself was, you know, all lost at sea in the penalty area because there's no one near him. Gross. It's interesting you ask about this because, like I say, he didn't necessarily have, you know, one of his barnstorming games, and yet, you know, was perfectly all right. I mean,
he did have an opportunity early in the first half it was a kind of like a cross shot, which Fabianski had to tip over under pressure from Shane Duffy. But I mean,
and if you're under pressure from Shane Duffy, you're going to know about it.
But yeah, no, it was quiet, and you know, perhaps the international breaks come at a good time for him to recharge his batteries.
Well, I think it's probably a good time for a lot of them. But having said that, Shane Duffy doesn't get a rest. Matt Ryan certainly doesn't get a rest.
Yeah. Have we decided which part of Glenn's body the ball actually did come off? I mean, some people say knee, some people say thigh, some people say shin.
Well, It really doesn't matter. It's about as a detail. I think it's about as relevant as the angle that the Titanic went down. It went in, and that's all you need to know.
But it was Knockhart's first assist of the season as well, I believe.
Well, at least he's got it in earlier than he did last season, which was the Birmingham game at Christmas last year. It's one of those dreamy crosses, which actually, to be honest, I mean, Murray was the only one in the box, which under probably normal circumstances would have been headed away. But it was appalling defending. It was real sort of Preston, I use that phrase again, it was that real Preston Park stuff. It really wasn't good. But, you know, that's Swansea's problem. But, I mean, we're talking about Shane Duffy, and I'm actually going to get back to John. We'll get back to the Swansea game in a sec, but I want to talk about this because Shane Duffy is a kind of a really good example of someone who seemed to come here and yet took... I mean, most players do take about two or three games to settle into the first team, you know, those who are brought in as first team players. One thing that seemed clear, and he seems to really try to catch up with Lewis Duncan doing this, is Shane Duffy's general play, not just the big sort of lump thumping the ball away with his head, the fact that he can actually get the ball down and play it. Mm. Because when he started with us, it really looked like he wasn't going to be able to do that.
Actually, to take it back even further, did you have him when you were working with Ireland?
No.
You didn't? Okay.
But, is that something that, you know, without being nasty to him to say that he couldn't do it, but is that just something that said, if you're going to play in this defence, this is what you're going to do?
It's interesting. I think from a recruitment point of view, when you're looking at players, you're looking at players that are going to fit into what you want.
Yeah.
So you might see a player who might not necessarily be playing good football or playing out from the back how you would want them to see, but that might not be the instructions from the manager. But you might see them in a different angle. You might see him playing for Ireland, might see him earlier on and think, do you know what, if he could do it and if we put him into our structure and the way we do things, I think he'll fit in well and he'll learn. Is he the type of player that's going to learn? Is he the type of player who's going to take new things on and want to do well and want to be in the Premier League? And if you tick all them boxes, then you'll go with that player.
The change in Shane Duffy from when he started, forget the first couple of games because he was clearly sort of, you know, a little bit of a fish out of water, but you know, the change between say the third or fourth game he played and now, it seems to be enormous. I won't say it's a different player, but there's certainly an element of a vastly improved one in as much as the boxes that he ticks there's a lot more of them.
Yeah, I mean he's a young player and I think as a pair, they're a fantastic pair. Mm. And if you could keep them together for a long time, they are very, very good Premier League pair of defenders.
I'm just hoping that it's not the future of the on-field club is actually dependent on those two. But at the moment, they are forming. They are the bedrock of the brackets, quote, success that we're having. I want to say success. Let's face it. You ask any given Brighton fan, unless you've got a total and utter misery, they've got to be delighted with the start that we've had. I mean, actually, tell us about it. Is there a buzz around the place with the
100%. 100%. It's a great place to be at the moment. And as much as everyone would be very, very happy of how we've done, no question, and you take that every day of the week, at the training ground, it's business as usual. And you're just looking
more.
You're just looking for just looking towards the next game. And yeah. You keep preparing and preparation and you do everything you can to the next game and you just keep going on to the next one. It sounds quite boring to look at that, but that's the way it is. And I think if you lose one or you win one, it's important to stay the same, keep doing the same things and just keep preparing and picking up your points as you go.
I suppose it's kind of interesting that way because there's so many players within the team, the club, for whom the Premier League is their first experience of it, and yet so many eventually have actually made that. I mean, some made the apparent step up probably earlier than others, but you know, it's probably fair to say that there's hardly anyone who hasn't now.
They've done fantastically well.
I mean, there was a touch of the rabbits in the headlines for the Man City game, but I think, you know, I think there was for the fans, to be honest. We were just sort of thinking, please don't let it be a cricket score.
Well, I think looking back now, I think you
were the two. I think they were taking it easy that day.
Yeah.
But, I mean, We're going to talk about Chelsea's academy as well.
Shortly.
Well, sadly, yeah. But I mean, one of their players was playing against us this weekend. So from your academy head on, what have you made of the handling of Tammy Abraham? Because I mean, he's now been called up to the England squad, and of course, he's a player that we were trying to sign in the summer.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting, like, from the academy point of view at Chelsea, they've got fantastic recruitment resources in order to pull in the best players, and they've got fantastic players throughout their age groups. Obviously, some they bring through, and some that they would obviously recruit in and would have a very, very powerful recruitment resource in terms of the money they spend to bring players in. But on the other side of that is that they are... It is a business model, and where they've got a lot of players out on loan, and they produce players, but ultimately they're at the moment. They've just whether that changes over time. There's a lot of players now going out on loan at the moment.
Okay. Now the thing is, it's interesting you say about that, and yet there's a lovely picture at the end of the Swansea Brighton game. Tammy Abraham sitting on his backside, Lewis Dunk sort of offers him a hand, and it's along the lines of, you know, I've got you out of my pocket now, kind of thing.
But back to another Chelsea loanee and decision making, which was it was Izzy Brown we're talking about, and he had the chance to do what was I believe is called a Sidwell. With Fabianski all hands up and all at sea, and he took the wrong decision.
Yes, I think that's just one of the issues that you have when you're watching. And of course, up in the West Stand, we're all knowing up there. You know, we were in the North Stand at the Goldstone. You know, we're old hands here. You know, our collective matches we've watched here runs into the thousands, so we all know exactly what's going on. And yeah, when we watch the team, and I'm sure it's part of the whole sort of training thing, is in a given situation, it's the decision making at that time. We from the gods up in the West Stand upper can see a pass that they can't necessarily see, and you think, well, they'll pass it to the left, and the better apparent pass was to the right. But then it depends on, you know, I guess on the training. I mean, it's, yeah, they've got to make that split second decision based on stuff that they probably can't see as easy as us. So it's frustrating.
That one was pretty easy to see, to be honest.
Well, yes, but I'm talking about sort of the whole notion of decision making in itself. I'm not going to pick one player just because of the nature. You know, everyone does it. Every player does it. It's you know, at any given moment, you know, when any, you know, more than one pass is on, you know, which one is the right one. So
okay, but it was moving on then. So it was a result that left us in eighth place, our highest league position for ever, pretty much.
Well, no, I think the highest we've ever got is in, it was only after about five or six games. There was one point in September 1981 where we were in fifth place. And I think that from about November to about February of that season, 81-82, we kind of occupied eighth and ninth. This is in a table of 22 teams. Now, let's face it. Let's call it for what it is. We're not going to get higher than seventh, so we can, you know, we're fairly close to our glass ceiling at the moment, and it is good at the moment, absolutely. But we've also got to resign ourselves just because of the way that this is. I'm sitting next to, you know, one of the coaches who hopefully isn't rolling his eyes, because I can't look at him at the moment to say, you know, there is going to be a time where it's not going to be as good as it is now. And we've got to roll with that.
We've got this tough run of games coming up. We've played 11 games in the last 100 days.
But we've got another
11 days in the games in the next 44 games. Days.
For the most part, though, we're picking up points where we thought we'd be picking up points. Sometimes it might be one instead of three, or three instead of one, but the point is the scoreboard is ticking over. You know, we've kept it going, and that's the kind of important point that, okay. You know, I mean, John's saying about they prepare for each game, but winning is a habit, but probably by the same token, losing that habit. And I'd like to think that there's not going to be that rut that we fear is going to happen.
Obviously, hopefully not, but... at the moment, everything. Yeah. I think we're doing really, really well. We're not conceding many goals, and if we start to add to that, then the amount of goals we score, great. I think we've been in every game that we played, and may that continue. There will come a time when it will get.
And that's the test for the characters.
And that's going to be the test,
it?
Yeah. But it's also vital then the amount of points then you're putting on the board, and.
I think if we can build ourselves that nest egg of points, I wouldn't say the team can relax, but at least you'll know that you know, assuming that we're coming, because I mean we've had this discussion so many times. Surely, even now, after just over a quarter of the season gone, we can see. I mean, things will change, things will improve, things will regress. Mm. But we can see there are easily three worse teams in this division than us. That's not to say
that's at the moment.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. That's at the moment. But my point is that as the season goes on, we as fans might feel one thing, but I think as the season goes on, it comes across that we have less and less to fear.
Well, 100%. I think the more points you pick up, the more confident you get, and you start on a roll. And then if you do it a wobbly patch, and hopefully it's just one or two games as opposed to five or six, and especially now they've picked up quite a few points and there's confidence in the camp, no question. And I'm sure that they'd think they'd give anyone a good game.
There was a quote from one of the players, and I can't remember which one it was, but he said, when talking about Chris Hughton, he says he doesn't let us get too high and he doesn't let us get too low. Yeah.
I think he has that effect on the fans as well. Mm. So, you know, apart from the game against Wigan where we absolutely went loopy.
Okay, well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We are brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com, and I'm just going to hand this over to John Morling here. Now, John, if you could just give us a brief description of what you are seeing here.
Red Lotto shirt, BHP sponsor.
Can you read the badge at all in this poor light?
No.
Has Phil photoshopped it?
A little bit.
The thing is, I think he's been threatening to do this. I think he was supposed to do it last week, but then we put up the Booker and McGee show, which you can incidentally listen to on Audio Boom.
I might mention that in a minute.
All right, okay, fine, all right, okay. But something tells me he's done an Australian shirt, and I can't remember, and I haven't seen it, I don't know, but I'm going to guess that's from Australia, that shirt, Adrian.
Well, Alan, how very dare you make that assertion? Of course, you are correct.
Okay.
Phil is currently in Australia. He's luckily managed to get tickets for the Australian playoff game against Honduras. We'll get to see Matt Ryan.
This is not an Australian shirt, surely.
Not the Australian national sign.
No.
No, it's not.
It's dodgy photoshopping, that's what this is.
I've been looking forward to saying this word all day, so here we go. This is a 1996 home shirt of Australian side, Wollongong.
Wollongong.
Well, actually known as Wollongong Wolves, in fact. The side play in the second tier of soccer in Australia, the National Premier League, in the North South Wales region. They play at the 23,000 capacity WIN Stadium, which is a stunning venue. Actually, I read this earlier. I had a look at this venue. If you get the chance to have a look at the WIN Stadium, amazing.
Why not call it the Wind Stadium? It's a great name. It's better than having the name of Lewes Stadium.
It's got three very nice covered stands with the east side of the ground completely open to the adjacent beach in the Tasmanian Sea.
That sounds horrific.
It's amazing. It looks beautiful.
Well, it's not exactly Canvey Island, is it? Which has got a similar concept, but
the most recognisable current player for the Wolves that I can find is Nick Montgomery, a Yorkshireman with more than 350 appearances for Sheffield United before he emigrated in 2012. He's played five seasons in the A-League for Central Coast Mariners before joining Wollongong at the beginning of 2017.
I would so laugh if that isn't how you pronounce it.
I believe it is. I believe it is.
Thank you, Phil.
But like I said, check that out if you can.
The shirt, actually, for a 1990 shirt, it isn't actually that bad. I mean, so there's been absolute real pigs of shirts, actually, but this one isn't too shabby at all. Phil will put it up on social media probably around the time that you're going to listen to this podcast.
So I'll try and find a picture of that stadium.
We'll put them up together at the same time when he puts them on Twitter and Facebook.
But we've got before we move on, we've just got a couple of things on the notice board. Firstly, the Albion women are in action this Sunday, Alan.
Yes, I mean, probably by the time the vast majority have listened to this podcast, it's too late, so. But yes, it's an international break. Let's give the women as much support as we can get. Let's get a lot of mob-handed. There is an excellent ale house. It's the Stanley Ale House just around the corner from Culver Road. So meet in there about midday for a 1 o'clock kickoff. Culver Road is always cold, even in June. However, just wrap up warm and come along and cheer the women on. It's Hope Powell's team is an ever-improving team. They had an excellent win against Spurs in the week. And the For all the fuss that people make about, oh, it's boring, it's women, it's this, it's that, just forget that. It's actually quite fast, quite exciting. And in Inu Umatong, we have a fantastic centre forward, big, strong, fast, an eye for goal. I fancy a decent sized win here. So to get yourselves along to Lancing, and it'll be a cracking game, I reckon.
And finally, on the notice board, you may have noticed that it wasn't our regular show last week. It was, in fact, the Our Life Theatre show with Bob Booker and Mark
McGee. We had a gas that day, didn't we?
It was great, of which the second half will be up at some point. But if you enjoyed that, Bob Booker has teamed up with Mickey Adams this time for a Q&A, which is at the Amex next Friday.
That's the 17th of November, for those that listen to it a week later. 17th of November at the Amex Q&A session. It's a tenner, including pie and a pint. And if you really, really want to, you can buy their book. And if you really want a good, expensive one, just make sure you get an unsigned one. But Mickey's got a biography out. Bob's got his biography out. And so you can then sort of read the pair and compare notes.
And I feel that I should give you a safety warning as well. Our show with Mark McGee and Bob Booker was in fact filmed, and it will be on the latest TV at some point.
Yeah, soon
it's
about
well.
Time, so yes.
So Jamie, you can see just how brilliant our faces for radio actually are.
You can. I think hashtag face or feces for radio, I think that's what more we are. You'll see how appropriate it is. But there is such a... You remember the old Colgate advertisement from the 1970s with the ping and the ring of confidence? That's what you've got, or the light shining on a lady's head.
Oh, thank you.
No problem.
I take that as a compliment.
I on the other hand, take up most of the screen.
Couldn't possibly comment.
No.
Right, okay, John, we mentioned this earlier, you came to the club in 2012, and one of the reasons you got the job was...
got the job.
Yeah, there was pogoing as well.
Yeah.
If the kids are united.
One of the reasons he got the job was...
In your experience in setting up academies.
Yeah, I was at, obviously, Peterborough for a long while, there for 12 years. As I said before, and then moved up all the ages, really, 9s to, as it was then, 17s, 19s, and then first team coach for the last 4 years. And then I moved to Ireland then to set up an emerging talent programme for Republic of Ireland. So basically what that was, you had your Sunday league clubs, and then you'd go straight into the international team. There's nothing in between. So we set up 12 regional centres.
Just pause you there. Sorry, did you say that players went from Sunday League to the international side?
Yeah, there was nothing in between. So it's a very different...
Well, this is at age group level?
Yeah, this is like under-15s, under-15s, under-16s, under-17s. So.
I was about to say, you got some fellow from the local pub team who's turned up for...
No.
Carry on. So,
but the structure there in Ireland that some of the... As we would say, Sunday League teams would be a very high level until they get to 16, 17, and then the National League clubs then would take over at that point. So we set up 12 regional centres, really, for 14s to 17s.
You say we, this is the Irish FA?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, Football Association of Ireland. And then that would then help any players, no matter where you lived, really, in Ireland, to get a chance of playing for Ireland. Because I think you go back 10 years, it's very much, very much Dublin based. Like, you know.
How do you judge how that went?
You judge it by the geographics of the international teams, how that changed, and how that would give players in rural Ireland a chance of playing for Republic. You would judge it by the... rankings, the FIFA rankings were the 17s, 19s and 21s at that point improved. And obviously players coming through the system would obviously judge that as well. Now, it's gone.
Okay. So when you came to the Albion, what was your original remit and how has that changed, if it has at all?
The original remit at the time was to, in line with the elite player performance plan that had just come out at the time, to go from Centre of Excellence to Category 2, as it was at that point. So that was obviously the first remit. And at that point, we were had to increase the training hours to be in line with Category 2 requirements.
All before Lancing opened.
There were seven different leisure centres that we was in at that point. Logistically, obviously, it was a lot different. You had players, obviously, in Eastbourne, players in Worthing. And at that point, they wouldn't see each other till match day, so it was very, very different. So then we had to try and increase the training in terms of the hours and that they did, introduce day release into some of the programs. And what day release is basically coming out of school to train. But obviously you have to do education that with that. We have a very good hybrid model at the moment, whereby under 15s and 16s have 2 days off school and they come in, but their days would look half 8 till 10, they'll do education, half 10 till 12, train, they'll do education again 1 till 3, and then train 3 till 5. So that's what their days would look like. 13s and 14s come in 1 day a week, and then 11s and 12s come in 1 day a week as well, and they're obviously supplemented by evening training as well.
Mm. Okay, so I mean, you're responsible for player development from the youngest age group right up to including the youth team. Now, the youngest age group, I believe, is from the age of 8. Is that right?
Under 9s is the first age group you can sign players. Yeah.
What is the benefit of an 8-year-old being involved in an academy? Because I mean, this is a bit of a hot potato because a lot of people don't agree with it.
Yeah,
including me, actually. But
yeah, so. If you get selected to play for Brighton or in any academy, you would obviously get good training, coaching, be a very high level. Your physiotherapy would be a very high level. You'd have education in terms of formal and informal education, workshops on different things, that your lifestyle development in loads of different areas. You play against good players every week. And if you're a Category 1 academy, you'll be playing against the best players in the country every week. So ultimately...
But what about the issue? I mean, I understand that if they are, from the age of 8, if they are involved with the club, they're not allowed to play for other teams and play with their mates or just be kids.
Yeah, they can play at the school, play for school, but they don't play for their club. And purely the reason for that is that they'll be doing a lot at the football club, because if you're a Category 1 player... and you're playing at the very highest level, you're going to be training 3 days a week. We encourage players to do other sports within that, and there'll be times at school, and we encourage, obviously, school activity, and especially the younger ages, to play other sports. But you have to be just careful and mindful, especially if you're growing, and depends on where you are maturity-wise in terms of your body, of how much you do. Because in your growing years, you have to obviously tailor your exercise program to make sure that you don't injure yourself and don't have an overuse injury.
But I mean, what is the benefit to the club of having 8-year-olds? Because presumably, out of every 10 8-year-olds you have that go through, you might get half an 8-year-old make the break.
What's the conversion rate of 8-year-olds up to?
I think the conversion rate would be tiny, and conversion rate of making it as a footballer is tiny. So. What we're trying to do is obviously get the best players possible in Sussex to play for Brighton, whether they're 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, whatever that might be, and provide them with a very good education both on and off the pitch, with ultimately giving them a better chance of making it as a professional footballer than what they would have done without that.
So how much actual scouting in the local area do you actually do? Because, I mean, I've heard that some of the top teams in Sussex have not even seen anyone from Brighton, but they've seen people from Portsmouth and Southampton, but no one from Brighton.
Yeah, no, there'd be a lot of scouts out, especially locally. And then obviously we have our talent centres for the younger ages spread around Sussex, and then we also have 4 talent ID centres.
Can you just tell us, I mean, you told us where one of them was earlier, and this will delight a few people, but can you tell us where a Brighton Hove Albion South Croydon branch is?
Whiteleaf.
Whiteleaf, which is kind of the leafy bit of the Burning Smell area, isn't it?
It is tree-lined suburbia.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have one at Whiteleaf, one at Carlshorton, Portsmouth,
and Carl Shorten's Palace Land as well.
Another one in Crawley. And then we have obviously 6 dotted around for the younger ones as well.
So isn't there a kind of a distance issue as to how far you can go out with encouraging people to join the academy?
Yeah, if you're an academy, you can sign players 9 to 12 within an hour radius, so training ground, and an hour and a half, then 12 to 16s, and then after 16s, you can.
So it's not a miles distance. I mean, because that sounds a little bit arbitrary. We say an hour what, on a push bike, an hour on a teleporter, or
it would be generally off a You can take it off a...
Sorry.
Yeah, IA Route Finder is what
right,
what the
okay.
Premier
so
League...
Right, OK, so it's kind of a little bit arbitrary, but yeah, OK. Yeah. So, cause,
you can do it by helicopter, no.
OK. So I don't know if this was the case. I mean, it was certainly stuff that was out and about. You don't hear about it so much. Was, you know, what some of the bigger clubs encouraging parents to move their children from the south of England to the north. We'll pay for this, we'll pay for that. Yeah. Move to, you know, just outside Manchester, move to just outside Sheffield, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And kind of almost sort of gerrymandering the whole thing of, you know, we want this kid, but we can't because they live 250 miles away. So we'll uproot their entire family. I mean, that's not the sort of thing that is that kind of media talk, or is that sort of thing genuinely happen? And does it happen?
Well, Barcelona
here?
Do it all the time.
Yeah, it's happened. Yeah, and there's quite a few detailed stories that have been in the news of players doing that. But if you've there's two different education systems. You can have an hybrid system or a full time model. Mm. If you've got a full-time model, you are allowed to move players nationally and educate them at your club from 12 upwards if you're going to provide full-time education for them. So you can actually do that.
Okay.
But there's a moral issue with that, whether that's right or wrong. We choose not to do that because I don't think we need to do it. We've got a very good hybrid model, what we do. Is it right to bring a 12-year-old from Manchester? No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. And that's something that...
As well as you're uprooting their family,
right.
Their culture, no. Their, yeah. You know, their extended family. And, yeah. and it leads to problems further down the line, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, some clubs would use private schools to educate their players, which would be fine for some, and not others. If you're, it depends what background you come to and whether that's a private school's right for you. I think everyone's individual and everyone needs a bespoke education programme, whether that's both football, education, both on and off the pitch.
What's the education model based on? Is it state school?
It would, yeah.
National curriculum?
Yeah, we would have part-time teachers. So we'll have nine teachers with each group. So that could mean 1-3, 1-4 ratio. It's a very good system. And if we're asking schools to let their students out, we have to make sure that their grades at least stayed to where they was, if not improve it. And in some cases, most of the cases, they will improve their grades. But we have obviously the links with the schools and with the parents that obviously if the players are not doing what they're meant to be doing, then we can then obviously use the playing side to say, listen, if you don't get up to scratch in your school stuff, you're not playing Sunday. That very rarely happens.
Sure.
So in order to... you've got to be as good off the pitch as what you are on the pitch. I think that's vital.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, moving up the age groups a little bit. Now, we've mentioned that some will come from the local area, but some is not so local.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, in terms of particularly with players that are late developers or have growth spurts, etc. But I mean, how do you actually identify that talent locally and internationally?
Well, we'll have a big recruitment network, and when you're saying about some managers locally might say that there ain't many Brighton scouts there, well, if locally someone says, a manager or something, you think you've got a player that would be good enough for Brighton and Albion, then contact Mark Endon at the academy. He's the head of recruitment, and we'll look at them, no problem, or we'll send someone out to have a look at them. So locally, we'd want the best players to come to Brighton.
Because you don't want to see them go anywhere else.
No, which has happened. Yeah, but some will happen, and some we might feel that at that particular time, you might make a decision on a player where you think somebody who's in your group is better than them, and you might have to release someone, and they go on to make it elsewhere. And if they do, then good luck to them. And obviously, we want to see people
make...
It's cool
you make at the time, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. I mean, I think if you had a magic... If you knew the magic formula, you'd be a millionaire. But with kids, there's no formula on it.
Well, I mean, we have brought in players from all over the place, from Scandinavia, and quite a few, which I'm guessing could be directly attributed to you, from the Emerald Isle.
Yeah, some would be. Obviously, I'd have good contacts in Ireland, and I'd have good contacts with all the international managers.
Because the three players are pretty much knocking on the door of the first team now, all Irish.
Yeah.
So that
Who
we
got in mind?
Jason Malumbi, Desi Hutchinson and Aaron Connolly.
Oh, well noted.
Yeah. I don't know, there's a dirty, gravy grin that's been slapped across John's face. You know, It sort of like, you know, straightens bow tie. Well, thank you very much.
It is crazy. I mean, with the development squad, we're seeing an awful lot of money being spent on bringing some of these players in. In fact, when you look at the amount that we're playing for first team players when we're with Dean, some of the fees we're playing for some of these people who are never going to see the first team in a million years dwarfs what got paid for Bobby Zamora when we sold him.
Yeah, I mean, I think the money obviously coming into the game is filtering down to 18s and 23s, and you're even paying compensation for younger players. But that is the case, and that's the market at the moment. And that's unfortunately the way it's going. Now, from a development point of view, it don't help one bit in terms of the amount of money that's coming into the game with your 18, 19, 20, 21. And you would want to definitely make sure that players earn that before they receive big sums of money, and which has been well documented. But in terms of making sure that they've got the hunger and be self-propelling to be as best they can, that's the most important thing.
How much of an example or an influence even is it to see the likes of Lewis Duncan, Solly March make the first team?
I think it's a big example to all the players, and it's very inspiring to all the players to see that they can do that. And to have players at the moment who have played in a Caribou Cup and train regular with the first team gives everyone inspiration, whether you're 9, 15, 16, that they can be the ones as well.
And to other players as well that may possibly be knocking on the door in the future, get sent out on loan to get valuable experience. I mean, Ben White at Newport being one of the success stories at the moment. Yeah. And from what we've heard, it sounds like he's going to be another one of our defensive...
We've got a lot of them.
another one from the defensive production line, which we're very, very strong at. If you could try and produce a striker, that'd be really, really good. That'd be really helpful. But how do you decide where these guys go on loan? Because, I mean, some of them aren't getting any game time at all at the moment.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, the loan situation, because the under-23 league could get a lot of flack from certain areas. And I think it's undue, because I think if you look at some of the under-23 games, technically and tactically, they're very, very high level. Very high level. But the one thing the under-23s league doesn't give you is that physical element that League 2, League 1 gives you, and obviously the first team environment of a crowd it doesn't give you. That's where the checker trade comes in. It's been a magnificent development tool for the players over the last 2 years.
It's been fast for all the lower league clubs, hasn't
it? Yeah, but if I look at it from a professional club point of view in terms of our development of our young players, it's brilliant, because it pitches them against senior professionals. And I think if you're a first team manager at Division 1, Division 2, and you come to a checker trade game, you've got more of an objective knowledge of what players could fit your club if you're thinking of taking them on loan. Because they're playing against men. I think that's a criticism if some managers would come to some of the 23 games and they say, well, but I'm not sure on the physicality side. Fine. But from a technical and tactical point of view, the league is a very, very high standard league. But you do need that other element to obviously for their development. But some players need loans, some players don't. And where it's important what managers you put certain players with. Certain players would benefit from an arm round manager. Certain players could handle a shout and scream manager. So it's very important you pick the right players with the right manager.
Also, probably the right that word again, philosophy, and that right sort of way of playing as well. You don't want to loan them out to a club that's going to be hoofing it.
No, you don't. But it's very hard to get someone who's going to be exactly the same philosophy as you. But we might have a situation where a defender we say he's very good on the ball and they play to a point, but his heading's going to get fantastic in this next 6 months. So we might do certain things for certain players.
But how much has promotion to the Premier League hindered their chances? I mean, presumably if we're still playing in the Championship, then they would have had more opportunity to possibly get game time in the first team.
Well, yeah, possibly. And I think if I look back, our highest amount of players in the first team would have been probably over the last three or four years was when, obviously, when Sammy's here. But we were full fifth from bottom at that time. Then our recruitment level went up. We got a much stronger team. We're challenging in the playoffs. Therefore, there's no games there at the end of the season where you could probably dip players in, etc. So it does become harder, because then if you're a first team manager, you say, right, well, who have you got there that's better than what we've got?
So when it comes to the overall, when we're talking about Lancing and when it was built and the whole sort of purpose and ethos behind it, it's been open since 2013. So obviously you joined the club before it opened. Now, what is there a kind of a time scale, you know, be it a plan by the club or an ambition by the club or even just professional reality of the conversion? You know, at what point are we expecting, you know, a lot? I don't know how you determine a lot, but you know, the flourishment of the academy to produce a great number of first team players. Is there a kind of a time scale on this?
There's no real time scale on it, but what we would say, what we're aiming towards is every start we'd love, our ultimate aim is to have 30% of every start, every team, every like 11 put out in the first team to be from academy products. That'd be that's our ultimate aim.
Well, I mean, obviously with the success of the age group teams, with the under 17s and the under 20s both winning the World Cup, I mean, obviously does that put any pressure on the clubs to find a pathway for them and fast track them? Because I mean, these are the stars of the future, and this is and at the end of the day, the name of the game is to get players into the international team and to make the national team as successful as possible and win World Cups themselves.
Well, the interesting part of that would be for the Premier League or for the EFL to put a quota on.
Do you think that will happen?
I think the enormity of the commercial side of the Premier League at the moment will make that difficult. However, with the teams doing well and the pressure now building, and I think the time will come whereby that could happen. And I think now than ever before, the Premier League, the EFL, the LMA, the PFA are probably closer now than probably what they've ever been. And now's the time really to push something like that. And if you're a youth developer, you would be obviously welcome.
Does that include Brighton and Hove Albion doing that?
I think everybody, across the board. I think all 92 clubs.
Would you have expected by now that sort of, you know, the bearing in mind it's been open 4 years, that fewer, the same number or more should have made it through to the first team by now? Or do you think it's a little unfair to ask that?
Yeah, I think it's a good question, and it's something that everyone would want to ask. But I think if you can imagine then Lancing opening 4 years ago and you was under nines and you've come in at nines, and really you've been working in that programme and they're only under 13 still. So by the time they get to 19s, 20s, 21s and you've had a full programme of them coming through, you expect more. But if I look at it from another perspective, in season 14-15 we had 15 international appearances from 23s down or 21s down at a point. Last year 16-17 there were 70, and if we keep producing players of international quality and keep the likes of Jason, the likes of Desi, the likes of Ben White, who are pushing through, it's just a matter of time now before they get a chance. And if they get a chance, then obviously they need to be ready to take it.
Okay. Sure. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much to Alan Wears, and of course, thank you to John Morland for coming
great
in.
Great stuff. I mean, could we come back, John? Because this is actually really genuinely interesting.
I think we've only just hit scratched the surface. But again, thanks to John Morland. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week. Bye. Thank you.